This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Welcome everybody, it's Rack Addicts After Hours episode 27. It is actually after hours again today, but we have unfortunately lost Telmo. No, he's a bit under the weather at the moment, so just Pete and I today. But we're gonna crack straight in. The weekly update, anything from you, Pete?
Several things. One, I'm still struggling to fault find my hex mix on channel 3.
Oh yeah,
which is finding quite perplexing. I've replaced a considerable amount of the components.
What was the fault?
Well, the fault is the indicator light, which I assume the one that the LED. Well, all the LEDs can either go red or green, and I suspect they indicate either a good signal or an overloaded signal in when it's functioning correctly. But in my case, as soon as you switch it on channel 3, the LED's solid red.
Mm.
So I've got the schematics and I've been poring over them, and it traverses. There's two circuit boards in the hex mix, and the circuit actually navigates. If you take an individual channel, it actually moves from one circuit board to the other, then back, man. And then
a bit of a nightmare to follow. Then,
well, yes, it's not too bad when I found that I could get the they're on a PDF, the schematics, and I actually edited them so I could get rid of all the other channels, so I could get rid of all the clutter, and I could just see one channel. And then I brought all the components locally so that they all had a sort of, they're all in context. So I'm unfortunately learning more about the circuitry of that particular product than I care to, but I'm determined. I will fix it, but
it's
quite frustrating at the moment, because I've moved all the op amps around, because they're obviously in standoff sockets on that on the full build version. I noticed there is a partial built version you can actually purchase where it's surface mount, but mine's the full build, which I believe is the one you built as well.
Yeah, mine was totally bare PCBs.
So you were quite lucky that you didn't test any of the components, threw it all together in one day and it all worked, whereas I tested all the components as best as I could, spent a week doing it, and I still got a fault.
That's basically how all of my builds go down. So I think I've just got a really good streak going, and at some point it's just going to fall through, and I'll have a dead module, and I'll be sad.
Well, I mean, and this could be anything. I'm suspecting it can't be one of the potentiometers. They all seem to be fine. It's just something really straightforward. So I've replaced all the transistors on that particular channel. I haven't. It may just be a capacitor. It might just be a bad capacitor somewhere that's sort of not allowing. So the way the current gets to the LED, the sort of the way that, because they're dual LEDs in respect that it's a single
three legs,
physical,
aren't they?
Yeah, so the triple, yeah. Three legs, so you've got your ground in the middle, then any positive voltage coming in one side will make it go red, and any positive voltage coming in the other side will make it go green. So there's a transistor that sits right in front of it, and when that transistor is switched on, the current goes to earth. So something is stopping that transistor switching on, I believe. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I've replaced those transistors. I've replaced, as I say, moved the op amps around, and I've changed some diodes, and I'm not getting anywhere. So I've actually given one of my colleagues who I work with on other projects, I've given him the schematics. I'm hoping, because he's got a much better understanding of looking at schematics and understanding exactly what's going on, just by, you know, rather than my sort of trial and error and trying to really work it out, he can just look at any generic schematics and go, well, obviously this is happening and that's happening, and I go, okay.
Yeah, I would have nowhere to go. It's like, it's not working.
Well, I'm using.
Check the solder traces. That's all I got.
Yeah. Have you ever tried? You know, you really need to understand something, so you just brute force it with your mind till your head hurts, sort of thing. I really need to understand.
No,
what's
I
going
think I
on.
Give up a lot quicker than that.
I get more dogmatic about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I do sort of give it a rest. If I continuously, I just sort of have a hissy fit and sort of have a temper tantrum. I have debated whether to buy a second hex mix, build it, and then sort of move the one board onto the other board and see which board.
Well, you've got with the all the Bafaco stuff, you can just send it to them, There's a certain, you can buy, what do they call it? I think they called it the happy ending. So you buy, I think you pay them like 50 euros or something, or maybe a little bit more. And then you send it to them, they'll fix it and send it back. They'll just guarantee you a working module, which is a really cool idea given that they sell so much DIY stuff. That's on their website somewhere.
Okay, seems to defeat the whole point of doing it. But I have written to them. I've written to the support and just said, look, I know it's the customer's responsibility, but this is my problem. Just give us a hint, you know, what part of the circuit you think.
They're all really cool at Bafaka. I've emailed back and forth with them quite a lot. I'm sure they'll
get
back to you eventually.
I've experienced this quite a lot at the moment. People aren't responding as quick as they might at the moment because of the sort of strange circumstances that we keep tiptoeing around in our conversations, so to speak. But so I haven't heard anything back from them yet, and I put it down. I had a good session over the weekend trying to resolve the issue, and I've left it for now, moved on to other things.
Speaking of other things.
Yes, on another note, my MIDI hub has arrived.
Was that a GoFundMe Kickstarter-y type something?
It was that type of thing, and I have mentioned it several times on the podcast before. So it was it was in that fashion, but I did it kind of independently. I can't remember if it was Indiegogo or Kickstarter it was actually on. So it has arrived. I haven't actually done anything with it. It's just again for everyone listening to us.
Well, that's me. I don't know what it is.
Well, it looks, it in some respects, if you're familiar with the sort of MIDI man, the MIDI sport.
Yeah, it looks a lot like the a slightly more swish version of a lot of the Kenton stuff.
Yeah, so it's just a small, what we'd say, sort of I don't know, 5 inches by 4 inches, is that a good approximation? I haven't got a measuring tape. Or if you want to go metric, what would you say, sort of 70 to 80 centimeters by 50 or 60 centimeters, something in that region. Steel.
Nah, 60 centimeters is like this. You missed.
Oh, I'm overestimating. 60 millimeters, good grief. I've gone all wrong with my metric there. But yeah, so each side you've got a row of traditional 5-pin DIN MIDI interfaces, so they're labeled in and out, and there's a corresponding little LEDs on the top that are labeled A through to D, so two LEDs. So I'm assuming that relates to each in and out, and there's another LED which again I'm assuming there's power. Then on the very end there's a USB-B socket, so you can attach it to a PC. There's a switch which isn't labeled up, so I can only assume that's powered it on or allows it to be powered on. And then a button. So whether that's a reset.
Probably like a learn or something.
Yeah, well, as I say, it's also got some brains to it. So it's not just a passive or a very basic MIDI hub in itself. It's got a kind of, I wouldn't say a door, but it's got a feature, kind of piano, MIDI piano roll feature, which you can access via some software that you can download from their website. And you can control it in that respect. So the idea for me was to create a doorless type of setup. So although there's something controlling the whole setup, i.e. the MIDI data has been fed to all the devices, there isn't a traditional door running in an operating system with all its complexities. It's just a basic, you know, MIDI pattern that it's feeding out to whatever equipment that you wanted to trigger. So I really should get round to actually plugging this thing in and having a play with it.
But rather than firing up Cubase to get and figuring out all your MIDI routings and things, you just open up that simple little program and chuck some sequences around your MIDI stuff.
Yes, that's it, exactly. And well, it's been a long wait. I'd like to say, I think it's nearly 8 months. It might not be quite that long, at least seven months. So, but I'm hoping it's worth the wait. It didn't actually cost too much. It was somewhere in the region of slightly north of £100 or so. I can't quite remember exactly what it's been so long, to be really honest.
Yeah.
But here it is, yes. So that was something. It's always nice to get something in the post.
Especially when it's an 8 month later surprise.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So that's really been it, apart from usual sort of stuff. Managed to actually procure a haircut. That was it, really.
You know, more aerodynamic now.
Yes.
Well, nothing's happened on my end, but one thing we were going to chat about, the whole doorless kind of setup, or and the varieties of that may exist. I've got into modular and synthy type things because I just really don't like DAWs. Obviously, for just recording, multi-track recording and mixing, fantastic. But for music creation, I like that to happen away from screens, which is why the modular world and its strange sequences did entice me. And at the moment, it's Digitact, bunch of modular, that's it. Just kind of profit. Although what I have been tossing around in terms of ideas lately is... you know MyVaults? They sort of make power supplies and bits and pieces. Pete, have you heard of MyVaults?
I'm struggling to remember the name, but maybe I'm more akin to remembering stuff visually. So if I saw it, go,
I know. They're just power supplies, so they're really, really boring. Thoroughly unmemorable. But they used to, or they still do, they're all over Amazon, just power supplies for whatever, and they'll have the product names that they're compatible with. So you can easily search MS-20 power supply, and it'll probably come up with one. But they've made some things called ripcords, which are USB to, you know, 9-volt, 12-volt, whatever adapters, and they've got little Y cables, so you can plug two USB ports in and get a barrel-shaped, you know, whatever voltage on the other end, which is pretty cool. So the idea I've been chucking around is battery power the Digitact, because I've seen people do that quite a lot. It's not too difficult if you've got a chunky battery, and then make some small modular case to bring along, so then I can just, you know, stick it all in the backpack, go into the forest and just make some music in nature, which again I've seen lots of people doing it. It's quite an appealing idea, but it's got me thinking about the whole modular system again. It's in front of me on my desk, and it just takes up so much room. I just want something small, just a small little case that can be more easily portable, because at the moment this thing weighs so much. I've got a backpack for it, and it's a little bit annoying. But yeah, that works for me without having to go near a piano roll. Digitact's a little bit weird, but if you get to know it, they're quite intuitive and easy to get whatever's in your brain down. What's your kind of setup for making music with your analog hardware at the moment, Pete?
Well, similar to you, I had the Digitact set up because I thought Digitact would be a good sort of a core brain, you know, for clocking and so forth. But unfortunately, it doesn't really have the piano roll type MIDI. It can be difficult when you get into that area. Hence the I leapt on purchasing the MIDI hub when that came available. But and again, I'm sure I might mention this again in the previous podcast. I've got the Digitac and the is it the AS1s, the Topaz, the Pioneer collaboration with Dave Smith. So a pair of those with one Digitac and a number of effects pedals, which are also MIDI controlled, and they're all on a guitar pedal board, one of the large ones that goes into a flight case. But it ends up being a really unwieldy, really heavy piece of equipment once you've got it all together. In fact, a lot of things, once you flight case them, they get really unwieldy. And I totally understand what you're saying about the modular case. So, I mean, what is the width on yours? Is it?
It's 6U104HP, so it's not massive.
Wider than, yeah, but still, it's amazing how much, once you get quite a few modules in, then how the weight builds up.
It's so heavy. It's not helped by the bag. The bag itself is pretty heavy as well. Obviously, power supplies and patch cables, and always take the key step with me, and it's big chunk.
I was I'm always thinking that I need, because I did have a small test rig for when I build modules just to make sure I can power them up. So it was the Zeus bus, the tip-top audio. But unfortunately, I passed that on to a colleague because I made him a case that he could take with him when he went abroad, and I utilized that because I just had it to hand, so I'm without any sort of source. So I was contemplating something else, and one of the things that I was looking at, in fact it was yesterday, was one of the very small
is it the 4MS pods?
No, even, well, smaller than that. It was one of the, I'm struggling to think. So it was one of the Dofer, that's what it was. It was one of the Dofer.
Oh, the ones that's like a little cube.
Yeah, so the really small Dofer ones, you can either get it as in the inexpensive case format where it's just bare plywood, or you do one where it's a kind of mottled vinil wrap,
I think they call that the vintage edition.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a little bijou handle on the top, and you can carry it around, and it's, I can't remember how many HP, it's something like 38 or something.
Yeah, they're really cute, actually. I quite like those.
So I thought something like that would just filled with two HP units.
It'd be amazing.
You know, so you've got all the functionality in a very, very small unit that you could literally... And again, something like that would be quite easy to battery power, I would imagine.
Yeah, definitely. I've been thinking about getting one of those just to put my Bafaco Crush Delay Spring Reverb and just a simple stereo in and out, just for... although the stereo is a bit redundant with two mono effects, but just for a little desktop effects box, because that'd be quite nice. Although I only have a stereo out from the interface, so... Fun ideas without the rest to back it up. That's what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to end up getting one. And then what it is something I can just mount units that I've just built, rather than sort of... Because generally I'm in a workshop building the unit, then I have to depart from the workshop, come into the house, go into the studio, plug them into the Moth, which is ridiculous, power that all up and see if it works. And if there's an issue, then go back out again. And I really need something on the workbench that I can just mount stuff in and just
sort
just
of like
test
a cheap set of maybe computer speakers, basic output module, and you've got your test bed going.
Yeah, or a set of headphones or something like that. So I shall most probably facilitate or purchase one of those sometime this week. So, but it's which one to go for, because there are other options of that sort of size, but that one actually comes with a power supply, which is always nice.
I've got my eye on the 4MS Pod. And since Thonk is almost reopened, because they have been selling their full range recently, but they're currently moving to new premises, I can almost get my hands on one.
Yes, I did go to peruse some pricing on some more Bifaco stuff. In fact, as you've been so complimentary about the crush delay,
it's so nice.
So I thought that would be a nice kit to possibly purchase. Because I did, unfortunately, in the deconstruction of my hex mix, I sort of gnarled up one of the little... I don't think you can even call them knobs. They're more like little shaft covers, aren't they? The little coloured...
Oh, the really small, the tiny plastic ones for like the EQ and stuff?
Yes, so yeah. I actually used some protection. I don't know if I used some foam or some material, just so that the pliers that I was sort of levering it off wouldn't bite, but unfortunately they chewed it up a bit. So you can easily buy them as spares from Bafaco, and I was wondering if you could actually get them from...
Yeah, they're on Thonk in lots of different colours as well.
I'll most probably go in that direction. But alas, there was a bigger message saying we are moving and we won't be open until...
Yeah. I've got about 36 hours left. I was on
yeah, there's a, I know ago. There's a countdown. So I can only imagine, I mean, they actually mostly reduced their offering right down to just some basic components.
It was just spares while they were kind of, I imagine they would have been putting in all the measures for social distancing and all that while they're trying to keep their workers safe. And I think it was a good idea. They've sort of kept open and now they're ramping up again.
I'm surprised because the amount of business they most probably missed out on, because the most probably the hunger for, you know,
I was just staring at the page going, because you could still browse their stuff.
Yes.
I was just staring at it and there was no add to cart button anymore.
You just can't purchase it. So I would imagine there's some easy way in the back end of those sort of websites where you could just shut off the actual cart side of things. So,
Crush Delay is so much fun. I haven't really used it too many times in that much of a musical way. I've actually used it in a track and been, that's exactly the right delay I want. But it's just so much fun to play with because you just give it some little basic little quick filter sweeps and little plucks and things and just play with the time control and it just goes mad. Really, really fun.
Yeah, and it's a really, really reasonably priced kit as well. Mm. And it's not, unlike some of the other ones because the hex mix
usual Bafaco style. It's quite dense but very straightforward build, easy instructions, usual thing.
And then I'm still trying to find a good source for a Clouds kit, one of the Cloud clones.
Yeah, have you been on Pusherman's yet?
Yes, I've had a good look. I'm sort of because there's various versions. There's versions that sort of follow the formats of the mutable instruments quite closely in the way everything's laid out, and then there's the redesigned ones.
Yeah. If you're not pushed for space, I think Typhoon is one of the better ones.
Yeah,
you've got sort of the mix controls on separate faders rather than having to click through a little menu and use the same one, which is everyone's frustration with clouds.
I noticed there's a lot of people offering built cloud units on eBay because, again, I think a lot of people have had a lot of spare time on their hands. So they've sort of utilized that. So, but a lot of them seem to be surface mount. So, I mean, I do a little bit of surface mount, but not
all
to
of
that
these, all of the mutable kind of redesigns, they're almost entirely surface mount all the time with some very small integrated circuits as well.
So it's something I potentially want to investigate, but I don't know if I need to go to the extent of having these small ovens and that procedure.
If you did, I mean, you could probably churn them out if you wanted.
Yeah, I'd have to do some serious research because that sounds like quite a lot of investment, and I don't know how inexpensively that can be done.
Yeah, I don't want to go there. I do want to pick your brains about upgrading to a nice Weller iron at some point because my Maplin special is frustratingly terrible.
Well, the Weller ones, it can be a bit of a minefield, but there are some shortcuts. I mean, the one I use or have used for many years is, I can't remember the model exactly, but I've had it, I want to say, a good 20 years. When I thought it failed, it was actually the iron that failed.
Oh, yeah.
When I thought it failed, I went out and bought a new power supply, and it was literally exactly the same model 20 years later.
Yeah.
And it's just
it ain't
big,
broke.
Just it was the iron had just burnt out, and they do just the element goes, but you can pick up the irons reasonably inexpensively if you go on eBay rather than go to RS Components or CPC or one of the big, and they're substantially cheaper, and that made the whole thing much more palatable. The power supply not so possible, and I think it was RS supplies. You can buy the power supply on its own. There are some more modern designs with digital readouts for temperature and all that sort of stuff, but I think it's a bit of overkill potentially.
I don't really need it. You can kind of just do it by feel, just how quickly it melts solder.
If
you see
temperature
burn
control,
marks, you're doing
which is
it wrong.
Quite accurate, but you just don't have a very OLED screen and all that sort of stuff. I think that's just a bit of overkill, to be honest.
Yeah, well, maybe some Antumbra stuff will be round the corner for me one day.
But I can give you all the models and the speeds and feeds and all the stuff,
awesome.
The stuff you need to know about that, and point you in the right direction for. As I say, I even bought a second iron. I bought two eventually, and I bought both of them reasonably, very inexpensively from eBay. And I've got no reason to suspect they're actually copies or fakes. They look identical to the genuine article, and they were a quarter of the cost.
Sounds perfect. Quite a screamer of a deal.
Yes.
The other bit that we did want to chat about today, we've touched on before about disruption of display. Yeah, I knew what I meant. Supply chains and things. And we were thinking, are we going to see any manufacturers completely, you know, disappear? Now, I haven't got any real thoughts on that, not really knowing too much of the ins and outs, but I had a thought while perusing the world of electric skateboards about a bit before COVID-19 hit. There was, you know, when sort of an import thing with lots of Chinese goods just hiking up the taxes on that kind of thing.
Yes.
It turns out that's actually what really gave boosted boards some trouble. I actually don't know if they did go under or not, but I know they laid off tons of staff. Actually, let's do a quick Google while we're at it. But yeah, they had a lot of trouble with these particular import duties on Chinese goods. And I did see a YouTube video the other day saying, is this kind of similar end going to be what's going to happen with the One Wheel, who make singular wheel kind of electric board? But that sort of, we didn't really talk about if we'd seen any impact of that, 'cause we did definitely mentioned it on a podcast, but that's, we have seen something there, so it's definitely possible that we are going to see some of our
So were they were that reliant on Chinese components, or I mean, one wheel? I can't remember whether I know that Casey Neistat was obviously a big proponent of them, and it was a big feature of his YouTube videos. His sort of navigating New York on his one wheel, the other one.
Yeah, so it's difficult to know sort of where they're sourcing everything, but I think Boosted really kicked off the whole electric, sort of simple electric transportation, so skateboards, scooters, and other alternative little electric kind of things. But yeah, they laid off tons of their staff because they have really quite bad financial difficulties. Because their electric skateboards are incredibly expensive. In England, you're talking I think their cheapest one's going to be about £900, and you're talking with some of the other manufacturers, you're talking up to $2,000 for an electric skateboard, and they're going to be sourcing, motor controllers and all that.
And that's sourcing the equipment in China, and it's still that expensive.
I imagine that's where they're getting everything from. Yeah, but motors, motor controllers, battery technology. That's kind of where it's all happened for them, and everyone was already complaining about how expensive they were, and I imagine they just couldn't do anything to make them more accessible.
Well, that's really exemplified how much reliance we've built up over the last two decades, I want to say, in respect to China. I'm ambivalent about the whole China thing to a greater degree, but this pandemic situation has kind of exemplified our total reliance in some areas, and so many different types of products, ranging from sort of medical equipment through to other things. So I mean, that's why you've got to wonder if we're going to actually see, because there's quite a few manufacturers where clearly the products are exclusively made in China, and we don't have to go into particular brands, but we know who they are, and then we go into the situation whereby, although they are fabricated in the UK or the USA or somewhere else in Europe, they're still reliant on a vast amount of components from China.
So yeah, they might source their parts, maybe even have boards populated over there. So many places are affected. I mean, difficult to know who's going to go first.
I wouldn't be surprised. The trouble is that someone actually, some familiar names disappear or get swept up, or maybe they're swept up by other more secure manufacturers and kept alive in that respect. But it's going to be interesting to watch over the next few months to see, because it'll come out of the blue. It'll be suddenly, because these sort of things are announced at the last minute. They don't tend to...
You just suddenly see headlines, such and such in administration. You go, wait, what? They weren't okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always sudden.
And I don't think it's just because their business model is particularly fragile, because a lot of these companies are doing particularly well.
They've got to go until they can't anymore. It does actually make me think of, I've definitely gone on about this quite a few times, those objects and pieces of equipment, or maybe it's just a bit of pottery that you have that is just really nicely handmade, and just feels reassuring in some way. To an extent, something like the Electron Digitact has that, because it's super chunky, the buttons feel amazing. But I'm thinking at the moment of, actually we had a quick chat about these before we started the podcast, but actually there's a company called Ernest Wright that makes scissors here in the UK, and that's just got me thinking about my favorite handmade-y type thing that I like to go on about all the time. But thinking about handmade, I suppose made by artisans, really. It does make you think jewellery sometimes, but a scissor is definitely going to be a tool. I imagine there's a certain feel of that about a really nice soldering iron. But Pete, have you got any bits and pieces that you can think, oh, that's a reassuringly solid, functional object that you just really enjoy? Because again, we found that in the SM7B. It's just going to work forever and probably outlast us.
The only thing I can think of that I've had for a long time, and it's a US product, is the Leatherman, the multi-tool.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are other makes, but I think the Leatherman's the original, possibly. It's certainly the first one I was aware of, and I've had the one that I've got. I have one in reserve as well, but the one I've got, I've had for 24 years, I want to say.
It's older than me. Amazing.
Yeah, and yeah, so it's kind of been with me thick and thin, and it just kind of, it's just there, and it's, you know, it just does what it needs to do. It's got all the sort of various tools, and it's pulled me out of a lot of scrapes.
Yeah, there is something really reassuring about that. It's like an old friend that you can rely on.
I think they're exclusively made in the USA, so it's a solid product in that respect. There's quite a few others that, unfortunately, you find out they're not as they're not made locally. I mean, going back to the scissor manufacturer, it's quite surprising how many of these small manufacturers still exist. I mean, how old is this? I think you told
1902. Yes. They were founded.
So yeah, again, so you have had these sort of small. I would imagine it's a family firm as well. Quite possibly.
Very, very possibly, yeah.
I mean, the one I saw the other day was a firm, and again, a UK firm, and they were hand-making paint brushes for art paint brushes, yeah. Like watercolour brushes.
That's not, is it, what are they called? Is it sable, or is that just a hair type or something?
Well, sable's a hair type.
Oh, yeah, I'm barking up the wrong tree.
and they were all made by these ladies who've been making these brushes for, you know, some of them for 40 years or however long, and they're all handmade, and the way they sort of get them to, you know, these watercolour brushes that always go form to a point. And there's an art of laying all the pile of all the, is it fur or is it some sort of synthetic? But
if I remember rightly, it's actually like a, is it a horse? Oh, wait, no, it's it's like a weird stoaty, long, little rodenty thing. Let me see. Weasel, apparently. A species of weasel, which is where this hair comes
weasel,
from.
I mean, where do you harvest your weasels for?
Who knows?
But they, as I say, they were hand-rolling these brushes. You know, and they have to be, you know, perfection. But they were excruciatingly expensive, these brushes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one brush was around the £100 mark.
That is a chunk.
That's for a small watercolour brush.
Oh, yeah.
So, but there's lots. I mean, one place where you find a lot of this sort of artisan and craftsmanship is Japan. There seems to be a tradition that they've held on to. Well, we seem to be, every time I see a documentary about Japan, they're always fabricating something sharp. Something
yeah.
Steel. But so many other things. And there's a passion to sort of maintain these traditions. You know, whether it's
I appreciate that. It's I like keeping that the family businesses alive. What's that? There's that the pencil museum in the Lake District. I can never remember which. There's sort of that one brand, but they're still going. Bear with me, I've got to Google this one.
Well, invariably, when you hear about these brands, you only hear about them when they're saying, unfortunately, they're having to close the business after 150 years.
Derwent. That's the one. Sorry, Derwent pencils. They're still going.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously they sort of find the sort of niche. They are the product that everybody who's in the know wants, and there's a sort of extreme demand for them. Were you telling me about these pencils where you have to? There's a waiting list for them.
No, but I do know about. Oh man, what are they called? Blackwing. Blackwing pencils, which I don't think the original company is still about anymore, but a certain quality to the graphite and however else they're made, but they were very highly sought after, and you know, sort of boxes going on eBay for ridiculous prices until somebody bought the rights to the construction method. So Blackwing is now back in business. There is also a really good great big story video on YouTube about a certain Japanese chalk manufacturer which professors were hoarding in universities.
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of. In fact, it wasn't pencils, it was chalk. And I remember they're all sort of, that's the one they want, these when they're sort of firing their equations onto, you know.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. It's difficult to put your finger on why it's such a special a special thing to have. Just, you know, it's really a quality item that's, and you can kind of trace its background. It's just a nice thing to be able to do.
Well, I imagine a lot to do with the chalk would be the quarry that it's mined from. A
certain level of purity that particular location has.
And again, I'm assuming that chalk or sticks of chalk aren't formed. They're actually machined in some way.
Or yeah, they're potentially.
They're not sort of
powdered and then squished into a mould. Yeah,
I could be wrong. That may be the way they're done, but I would imagine that, unless I'm incorrect, that they actually come from pure blocks of chalk, possibly. But that could be a misperception. I'm no affiliate of the intricacies of how chalk sticks or for chalk boards is fabricated or constructed or...
Actually,
manufactured.
I've just gone off on a tangent on that one. It's always really... really exciting to hear, even if you're really, really not interested in whatever the end kind of thing is. But if you ever have the luxury of hearing the level of expertise and knowledge that a master craftsman of something or somebody who's an absolute master of their job, if they ever get to talk about what they're doing, even if you don't understand it or you don't care about it, there's still an immense pleasure to be had in just listening. And you can kind of feel the presence of some serious power in whatever field they're in, you know. So I was, where was this? Do you know the Dymchurch Light Railway in Kent?
Yes,
somewhere.
I'm certainly familiar with it. It's quite one of the more famous ones in the UK.
I haven't been there for ages, but went on it with a friend. His dad is somewhat eccentric, but a really interesting man. And we were at one of the stations. And they had, you know, the old-fashioned hand-done kind of signal box. And he went up to the guy who was in there and just said, can you tell me how this all works? And he did. He'd been there for 50 years or more just operating this signal box. And he went through this incredible explanation of how all the particular mechanisms functioned. And I was, I don't know, 13. I don't care about how a train signal box worked, but that was one of those moments where I actually realized the kind of knowledge and experience that somebody had and the how special it can be if they're willing to share that. So if you can ever do that, meet somebody who is a master of their craft, particularly in that kind of semi-lost art type way, blacksmiths. I've spoken to a few blacksmiths, but it's a real pleasure. If they share their wisdom.
That kind of feeds somewhat into what I've stated about some of the YouTube picks.
Absolutely.
That I've done. The one from a few weeks ago, which was the Samson Boat Company, when I said there's something cathartic or therapeutic about watching craftsmen who are very sort of accomplished or proficient at their craft just working. There's something although they might be working quite vigorously and expending a lot of energy, there's something sort of soothing and relaxing about watching that process.
Well let's actually jump into our YouTube recommendations for this week. Mine will be the Bob Ross of Bonsai. I don't think I've mentioned him before, but his name is Peter Chan. He has a bonsai nursery called Heron's Bonsai, which is on the way to Kent, actually. Lots of Kent-themed things this episode. It's a really fantastic place if you ever get the opportunity to go. You can peruse the bonsai, and they'll have, obviously, supplies. I do need to pop down to get a couple of pots, actually. Hopefully I can do that at some point soon. But the YouTube channel, again, Heron's Bonsai, it'll just take you through pruning strategies for different tree species and certain seasons. He'll walk you through the nursery just to take a look at some of their sort of specimen trees. And he's got such a soothing voice, and he's been doing this for ages. He's won lots of awards at the Chelsea Flower Show. He's done the bonsai area at RHS Wisley. But he's got a very relaxing voice, and he just knows so much about bonsai, but wonderful stuff to watch. It's sometimes I'll do this with Bob Ross videos or even Peter Chan. His videos, just have a bath, glass of wine, relax, and then just sort of watch one of those videos. It's an excellent way to spend your evening if you just need a bit of calming YouTube. What have you got, Pete?
Right, well, it's quite a popular channel that I was going to recommend, and many listeners may already be familiar with it, but it's called Abroad in Japan, and it's this English expat. So this gentleman started making YouTube videos almost from the get-go, from when he emigrated there. He's been there for about 8 years in total now. And there are quite a few of these type of Japanology, or whatever they want to call it. Type, but there's certainly quite a few videos there where people have relocated and may live in Tokyo or other prefectures, and do lots of kind of the usual sort of thing, you know, going visiting the sites and eating the food and all that sort of thing, and recommendations about traveling to Japan and touring around Japan, which this guy does. But he's also got a kind of very dry, almost acerbic sense of humor, very self-deprecating in some respects, so it's got quite a lot of personality. And I've watched him, his subscriber level build up quite rapidly. So when I started, I think he had quite a few. He was at the 400,000 mark or so, maybe slightly less. He's now on the 1.6 million
I didn't realize he was that big.
Yes, and he's done quite a few. I mean, when you get to that stage, you start getting sort of all sorts of crossover invitations, as you can imagine. And he does collaborate with other expats that he's familiar with on quite a few occasions. And he's got a few Japanese friends, which they seem to be quite... or take it quite light-hearted. He can be quite, not in a nasty way, but he can be quite derogatory about them, but in a very sort of English jovial way. And he's not that frequent with his videos. He can be a bit sporadic. I mean, he did a sort of tour of Japan last year by cycle, and he pledged that he was going to put a video up every day, and he did for quite a few days. And then after that, there was a bit of a gap, and then there was a really big gap, and then and then there was months, and then he put out some more. I mean, so, but having done a few YouTube videos, I know that it's quite stressful, and there's a lot of work if you're trying to produce something of reasonable quality. So I don't hold it against him. But he's done quite interesting ones. Again, lots of travel, lots of dining and all that type of stuff. But he'll do simple straight to camera from his apartment. And consequently, during the pandemic, he's been doing mostly those over the last couple of months. But even those can be quite witty, quite well put together. It's not over polished, the productions, but there's just something. I think mainly it sort of resolves around his personality. He just kind of works. So I can see the channel continuing to grow. I'm not quite sure whether it will develop in any other directions, but I'm always happy to watch any of his videos when he puts one up.
Nice one. Well, a couple of we've got a lot to binge with Abroad in Japan, and maybe if you do need a long, relaxing video, because Heron's Bonsai videos are normally quite long, you'll be well served for entertainment this week. Thank you very much for listening, and you'll be hearing us next time, I hope, potentially from the outside world again. Hopefully the weather is kind to us once more. But everybody stay safe. We'll see you in the next one. Bye now.